I want to start where I left off last year. I'm sure you'll remember. I want to speak about a few important ideas to remember if you want to be mashpia, if you want to influence other people. And if you want to be involved in Kiruv, then it helps very much to be able to influence other people. The first lesson is something that I had wanted to say at the end of last year's Yom Iyun, but the time ran out. So I saved it for this year. But it's extremely important. Rashi brings down in Divrei Hayomim that whenever Klal Yisrael get together to say kinos for various tragedies, as we do on Tisha B'Av, there is a takana from the Nevi'im Harishonim to add a kina for Yoshiyahu HaMelech. You must mention Yoshiyahu HaMelech amongst the kinos. And we do on Tisha B'Av. There is a kina that starts by Yikonen Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu. Why? Why is the tragedy of Yoshiyahu so fundamental that whenever we mention any other tzaris, we have to include that too? So I think one possible idea is the following. First, we have to understand what exactly happened to Yoshiyahu. The Kitzer, Yoshiyahu was a tzaddik, the son of a rasha, the grandson of a rasha, Menashe, Amon, were terrible Rishoyim. Menashe we know. Amon was even worse. And Yoshiyahu, from the time he was 8 years old, already he was a Baal Tshuva. And he was a tzaddik. And he went on a Kiruv campaign in Klal Yisrael. And he sent soldiers, officers, policemen, house to house, to eradicate the Avodah Zarah. And the late Sonny Hador, the Kino says, fooled him. And they made their Avodah Zarah on the backs of double doors. So when you closed the door, the Avodah Zarah was there. When the doors were open, you couldn't discern that it was Avodah Zarah. So when the policemen came in and they opened the doors, they didn't see any Avodah Zarah. When they closed the doors behind them, the Avodah Zarah became evident again. Yoshiyahu thought that he had influenced Klal Yisrael and that he eradicated Avodah Zarah, and therefore when Paro Necho, king of Egypt, asked for permission to pass through Eretz Yisrael on his way to Ashur, to Assyria, to fight the Assyrians, Yoshiyahu told him that he can't give him permission. Because we have a bracha in Bechukosai Teleichu. If Klal Yisrael is on the right level, then Becheret lo safer bi'artzechem. Then a sword will not even pass through Eretz Yisrael, afilu cheret shel shalom. Even an army that's not interested in waging war with us, but's on its way to wage war with someone else. So Yoshiyahu refused. Yirmiyahu Hanavi told Yoshiyahu he's making a mistake. First of all, Klal Yisrael aren't on that level. They fooled him. And secondly, Ribono Shel Olam's will is the Sachseich Mitzrayim b'Mitzrayim. He wants Egypt to go and fight Ashur. And Yoshiyahu refused to listen. He told Yirmiyahu, I can learn a pasuk kol mishnah as good as you. And my chumash, it says, v'cherev lo savra b'artzefen. Paro was not too happy about Yoshiyahu's refusal. And he told his soldiers that they're going through no matter what, and they have no bone to pick with the Jewish people, just with Yoshiyahu, and they should make him the target of their arrows and spears, which they did. And they filled his body with spears, And with his last breath, Yirmiyahu went on the battlefield to hear what he was saying. And he was matzdik alav sadin, sadiku Hashem, kipiu marisi. And then Yirmiyahu composed the fourth parak of Eicha as a eulogy to Yoshiyahu. That, in a nutshell, is the tragedy of Yoshiyahu. What do we learn from there? Yoshiyahu had tremendous kavanas l'shem shamayim. He wanted very much to influence the Jewish people. He wanted to be mekarev people. Why wasn't he successful? So I'll tell you what I think. Because in Klal Yisrael, there's a pecking order. There's an order of authority. Big Rosh Yeshiva have to listen to the Gadol Hador. And the little Rosh Yeshiva have to listen to the big Rosh Yeshiva. And Balabatim have to listen to the Rabbanim. And Rabbanim have to listen to Gedolei HaRabbanim. And lesser Balabatim have to listen to greater Balabatim. And children have to listen to their parents. And when that order is kept, then Shalom al Yisrael. That's like by Har Sinai. Yiladim mechabdim nesahorim, horim mechabdim nesaskenim, and then there's Matan Torah. But if that order is disrupted, and people do not listen to the authority of people above them, then neither keneged mida, the people who are supposed to listen to them, or the people they want to listen to them, won't listen to them either. Because Yoshiyahu didn't listen to Yirmiyahu, the melech has to follow the Nabi. The Magid, the Vilna Magid, says that Malachim came from Peretz and Nevi'im came from Zerach. How were those two twins born? Zerach stuck out his hand, and then the hand came back into the womb, and Peretz pushed his way out, and he came out first. Says Reblei Vilkamir that is the way the Klal Yisrael has to function. The Navi points the direction for the Melech to follow, and then the Melech is pulled together and he affects what the Navi says to do. But the order is the Navi directs and the Melech follows. When the Melech doesn't listen to the Navi, then the people don't listen to the Melech. So if you want to be successful in Kiruv, and you want to have people listen to you and be inspired by you, then you have to make sure that you listen to the people that you're supposed to listen to. Whether it's your Rebbe, whether it's Gedolei Hador, whether it's Rosh Yeshivas, wherever you're holding. If you're the Gadol Hador, so you have to listen to the Gedolim of a previous generation. Whoever it is that you're holding in that order of authority that you have to listen to, you'll only be successful to have the people beneath you listen to you if you listen to them. First lesson. Second lesson. If you want to inspire and influence people, then you have to speak their language. And you have to package the Torah in a way that relates to the people that you're dealing with. Torah says, "B'chodesh hashlishi l'tzeis b'nei Yisrael mi'eretz Mitzrayim, b'yom hazeh bo midbar Sinai." Doesn't say b'yom ahu, b'yom hazeh. We learn from that, "B'chol yom yu b'einecho kechadoshim ki'ilu hayom nitnu." Torah has to always be new, as if it was given that day. Now we normally learn that means that just like when the Torah was given, it was exciting, not old, stale. So every day the Torah has to be new and exciting. Just as if it was given that day. But that can't be the limud here. That is the limud in other places. That we learn from those psukim. But this pasuk can't mean that. I'll tell you why. Because we didn't get the Torah that day. Bayom HaZeh is the day they came to Midbar Sinai, which was Rosh Chodesh Sivan. They didn't get the Torah on Rosh Chodesh Sivan. They got it on Shishi or Shvi the Sivan. So what are you going to tell me? The process started on Rosh Chodesh Sivan. Not true. Look in the Gemara in Shabbos, and the Gemara says the process didn't start till the second day of Sivan. Because the first day of Sivan, the people were tired. Michulsha de Urcha. They just made a big trip from Rafidim, and they were tired. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them time to unpack and to rest, and he didn't start the process of Matan Torah till the next day. So how in the world can we learn from that day they came to Midbar Sinai, the Torah should be new to you every day as if it was given that day, when then nothing was given that day. Nothing happened that day. They rested that day. That was it. I therefore think that that's exactly the lesson. HaKadosh Baruch Hu waited for that moment of Klal Yisrael, the right people, the right number, the right time, the right place to come from before the creation of the world. 26 generations he's been waiting for this. You would think he would want to start right away. But the Rebbe Nachum assessed the situation and he saw that the Yidden were tired. And if he'd start checking them about Matan Torah that day, it would be counterproductive. So he let them rest and didn't start with them till the next day when they were slept, refreshed, and ready for Matan Torah. That's what we learn from there. Every day, you have to assess the Torah anew, as if it was given that day, and not assume that you can deal with the Torah the way you dealt with it the day before. Because every day is a different day. Every situation is a different situation. And what was good for yesterday's situation may not be good for today's situation. So what I'm saying is that the Torah has to adapt, or you have to adapt the Torah to situations, to time and place, circumstance, which we'll see. Now on the surface, that sounds like conservative reform. Torah has to adapt to places and times. Torah is eternal, immutable. How can you say that the Torah has to be adapted? And I'm not a reform rabbi, even though one of my sons may think that I'm close to it, but in any case, not exactly. So what's the pshat? So let me tell you that the Michtav Meliyahu says something like that. So is the Chazon Ish. The Michtav Meliyahu says that the Yetzer Hara of every generation is different. And the way to combat that Yetzer Hara is by fighting fire with fire. By combating the Yetzer Hara on his turf. The example he gives, the Yetzer Hara in the time of the Rambam was Greek philosophy. They believed in Aristotle, whatever he said was true, and where Aristotle contradicted the Torah, then the Torah must be wrong. That was the Yetzer Hara, Greek philosophy. So what did the Rambam do? He wrote Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, where he showed that where Aristotle was right, he didn't contradict the Torah, and where he did, he was wrong. And that way he counteracted that Yetzer Hara. I don't know what you came today to this Yom Iyun for. If you think the Torah never has to be adapted to circumstances, then you shouldn't have come here. You could have become an excellent Kiruv person by just going and copying some choice portions, probably in English, from the Mora Nevuchim. Go down to a Kikar Tzion, call all of the estranged young people out of the pubs, and tell them, I know what's bothering you. You think that Aristotle is the final word in truth. So I'm going to read you some sections from Mora Nevuchim, and in that way you'll be able to be makariv thousands. You won't be makariv anybody. You know why? Because the Yetzer Hara of this generation is not Greek philosophy, nor any philosophy. They don't know if you know who Aristotle is. They think he's a rock star. You'll excuse the insult, but the deepest thought of this generation is perhaps should I have ketchup or mustard on my hot dog? And even that's difficult for people to think about. That's not the Yetzer Hara of this generation. The Yetzer Hara of this generation is more hedonistic, is more gashmius. It's not philosophy. You're not going to be makarid to anybody by reading the Mora Nevuchim. In the Rambam's time, that's what worked, because in the Rambam's time, that's what the Yetzer Hara was. Torah didn't change, but people change. And the world changes. And the Yetzer Hara changes. And you have to adapt the Torah, not change the Torah. Torah doesn't change, but the packaging changes. You have to adapt the Torah to the circumstances. And if you don't understand that, then fundamental right and wrong eludes you. I'll tell you another word. When we left Mitzrayim, we had a mitzvah to take gold and silver and Egyptian clothing. And the Rabban Shem told us what to do with the clothing. Put it on your children. It's very, very strange. For 210 years, one of the zechuyos we had to leave Egypt was we didn't change our mode of dress. We didn't wear Egyptian clothing. And now, all of a sudden, we're going out of Mitzrayim, and the Rabban Shem says, put on the Egyptian clothing. What? What was the purpose? So I'll tell you what I think. There's a kliyoker there, you can look, he has a pshat and why the clothing. I'll tell you a different pshat. And I think that it's korov lios emes. If not in this, the idea is for sure emes. Tell you a story, and then we'll apply it. When I was in high school, so the rage in the world at the time was the Beatles. Not the six-legged variety, but the two-legged variety. For those who either don't know who the Beatles were or don't want to admit that they know who the Beatles were, I will tell you who they were. The Beatles were a rock band from Liverpool, England. And they started a fad in the world that up until that point hadn't existed. Up until that point, men did not have long hair unless you were a hippie. Hippies had long hair. Respectable professionals did not grow long hair. But Ringo Starr, the drummer of the Beatles, had long hair. And since that was the fad in the world, it became fashionable for even respectable men to grow long hair. And whatever affects the non-Jewish world doesn't take long to affect the Jewish world. So I went to a Masifta high school in Miami, and some of my friends stopped taking haircuts. And after 2-3 months, it started looking like a co-ed school. So one Friday, my Rebbeim called in these boys, and he said to them, if you don't go today and take a haircut, a normal haircut, L'Kavod Shabbos, and start looking like boys again, then don't bother coming to school on Sunday. You are out of school until you take a haircut. My friends were not easily discouraged. So they said, Rebbe, a Nazir has a long hair and he's called a holy person. All we want to do is be holy. They said, did you ever look at a picture of the Ragachev or Gaon, of Yosef Rosen? He had a gigantic head of hair. They say that he never wanted to take his yarmulke off. He never stopped learning. So he didn't take haircuts. Tremendous head of hair. Rebbe, we just want to be like the Ragachev. My Rebbeim were not fazed by these arguments because, true, it may be that in a vacuum, halachically speaking, there may not be anything halachically wrong with long hair for a man. Could be. But if the reason you glow, and therefore, the Ragachever can have long hair, and a Nazir can have long hair. But if the reason you're growing long hair is to be like the Beatles, that is treifes chaza. That makes it wrong. Same thing, that's what the Rabban Shem wanted to teach us. You should know that this clothing, there's nothing halachically wrong with it from the four sections of the Shulchan Aruch. Go through them all, you won't find it's not pritzes, because otherwise you couldn't wear it in the desert. It's not shatnez, otherwise they couldn't wear it in the desert. I want you to wear that clothing. I want you to know it's 100% glatt kosher clothing. But had you worn that 100% glatt kosher clothing in Egypt, you never would have gone out. How come? Because in Egypt you would have been wearing it to be like an Egyptian, and that's treif. In the desert, there's no Egyptians around. There's nothing wrong with wearing that clothing. But in Egypt, it's wrong. I'll give you another example. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so the first sukkah I went to buy Israeli Yerushalmi Sukkah decorations in Meir Shorim, because I didn't want to have my Sukkah decorations from America. I wanted the real thing, Yerushalmi. And I was astounded, because the real Yerushalmi Sukkah decorations looked very much like what I used to see as Christmas decorations. And looking even closer, they were Christmas decorations. In the original packaging, season's greetings. And these Yerushalmis were buying them up. I was sure I was going to go Chol HaMoed into Meir Shorim and see a sukkah with a little baby and some shepherds around it. And the guy telling me, look, I'm some mishpacha, beautiful new sukkah decoration. Now, in Meir Shorim, there are no churches, there are no Christians. They never saw a Christmas tree, and they never saw Christmas decorations. I'm sure that if a Yerushalmi found himself in December in New York, he would say, wow, these guys stole our sukkah decorations. And therefore, in that place, could be there's no chukas hagoyim. It's not osur at all. It has no implications at all. Those same decorations in New York may be osur because of chukas hagoyim. Depends on the place. In one place it's okay, another place not okay. Something that could be glatt kosher, Tanakh. What could be wrong with Tanakh? But when the Haskalah made Tanakh the substitute for all Torah, for Gemara, for Torah Shabbat Peh, then Tanakh became awesome. And they stopped learning Tanakh in yeshivas. So in one place, in one time, what's asur may be mutter 100% in a different place and a different time. If you don't understand that you have to adapt the Torah to the time, to the place, to the circumstance, and it's not one monolithic thing everywhere, then you're going to end up doing things in one place that are mutter, and when you go to another place, they could be that same thing as asur. More than that. I'll give you another example for the Chazon Ish. Just so you see that it's endless. When the Beis Yaakov Chinuch Atzmoi school system was formed by Gedolei Yisrael in the 1950s, the independent school system that has no connection, not dependent on the government here. So the question was, what language was going to be the language of instruction? So everybody assumed that it was going to be Yiddish, because Ivrit was surely not an option, because the Yishuv HaYoshan of Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld made a holy war against Ivrit. They say that Eliezer ben Yehuda, the father of modern Hebrew, once met Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. Somebody once told me they have a tradition in their family. They are the family of Rabbi Adler, Yerushalmi Magid, that the Maisa happened about their relative, Rabbi Adler, and not Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. But in any case, it happened about one of them, or may happen about either of them. You'll see in 1 second. It's an interesting fable, maybe. Brings out a point. He met him, and Eliezer ben Yehuda said to Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, I don't understand the Rav. What do you have against Hebrew? Hebrew's Lashon HaKodesh. How could you have a war against Hebrew? Rabbi Yosef Chaim said to him the following. He said, you know, wine is a very, very holy thing. It's also Kodesh. You could use it for Yain, for Kiddush, and Havdalah, and Koshel Bracha, and Sheva Brachas. But if the wrong kind of person touches the wine, it becomes prohibited. It says in Shir HaShirim, Chikech Kiyein HaTov. Your palate is like good wine. Just like wine can become Asur, if the wrong person touches it, language can also become Asur. Lashon HaKodesh can become Asur if the wrong person touches it, like you. That's what Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld said. To that, Eliezer ben Yehuda responded, HaRav Medaber Shtusim. The Rav is speaking foolishness. To which Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld responded, Be'ivrit Omrim Shtuyot. Not Shtusim. In any case, whether it happened or not, I don't know, but it's a cute word. So they made a holy war against Ivrit. They called it Ivrit with two vavs, the blind language. So everybody assumed that in the Torah schools, they're going to teach in Yiddish. The Chazon Ish who had to paskin what they're going to do, said they're going to teach in Ivrit. Not Ivrish, Ivrit. Spoken Hebrew. So they already had the Chazon Ish's name on the walls in Meir Shearim, put him in Cheirim. Right? Chazon Ish already was a Zionist, he was off the derech. So somebody went to him, and they asked him, how you talking? He said, look, if you had a general in World War I who was an excellent strategist, and he won many, many air fights in World War I, and you take him out of retirement, now it's World War II, and you ask him to write up a strategy for an air battle that's going to take place, and he gives you a strategy that involves box planes, put him back into retirement. They're not fighting with box planes anymore. They're fighting with jets. So you need a different kind of strategy. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld said the Chazon Ish was fighting a war against people who grew up in frum homes, whose consciences bothered them that they were totally giving up the Torah. So they needed something to substitute for the Torah in order to ease their consciences. So they had Israel and Lashon HaKodesh and Hebrew, and as long as you lived in Eretz Yisrael and you spoke Hebrew, you didn't need a Torah. Torah was for Chutz La'aretz. But you were enough to be Jewish if you lived in Eretz Yisrael and spoke Hebrew. In that war, he had to show that Hebrew was not that important. That's not what makes you a Jew. And not living in Eretz Yisrael, Torah makes you a Jew. Torah happens to speak about Lashon HaKodesh and Eretz Yisrael also. But that's not a substitute for Torah. Says the Chazon Ish, that war we've lost. We lost that war long ago. We're fighting a different war. We're not fighting people who grew up in frum homes. We're fighting people who are assimilated already, far from Torah for two or three generations. And if we don't teach in our schools in the vernacular, in the language that's spoken, we're going to lose more of that generation. So our war is a different war and it needs different weapons. And the weapon here is to teach in spoken Hebrew. Because that's the way that we'll be able to get to the generation. True, the generals decide what the weapons are, not every soldier. But you have to understand that the generals understand that times change and situations change, and what's okay in one place is not okay in another place. And what's wrong in one place may be 100% okay in another place. And the way to deal with certain people is a different way in dealing. You're giving a chabura in Nir, then the way you talk to the people is maybe yeshivishis. But if you're talking to people who never heard a word of yeshivishis in his life, and they speak English, so they have to speak English, and speak it well. Because if you speak to them in a way that they look at you like you're from Mars, or worse, then you're not going to get the message across. And that's why the Navi begs the Ribbono Shel Olam, Nison li loshon limudim, la'uf le'us davar. The Tezer Rosh Hashiva explains, what does it mean? The Navi begged the Ribbono Shel Olam to give him loshon limudim, a learned way of speaking, that he knows who he's speaking to, who his audience is, and how to reach them, and how to phrase things properly, for whom he's talking to, and to make what he's saying timely, to fit the time and the place and the circumstances. La'us, from Lashon Ace, time. I'll tell you another mindset, where I learned how important this is. When I was a rabbi in Miami, Shabbos, the frum community needed a chizuk. There were a lot of people who had never learned Hilcha Shabbos, who were elderly people who never went to a day school. They didn't exist when they were younger, or they didn't have a chance. They went to public school and to Hebrew school. And they were frum because their parents were frum, or they became Bali Tshuva through Young Israel or something like that. But they never had a chance to really learn. So they were Shomer Shabbos. They didn't drive. They didn't turn on lights. They didn't answer the phone. But they didn't have any clue about Hilcha Shabbos. So many of them carried their handkerchiefs to shul, and we didn't have an Eruv at the time. And there was a lot of things that people were not aware of and didn't realize how important they were. the details of Hilchos Shabbos. So we decided, the Rabbonim of the area, two shuls in our section, got together, and we decided to bring in a Choshev Rav from out of town, who I won't mention where or who, because what I'm going to tell you is pure Lashon Hara. But it's not Motzi Shemu. And this, we're going to have a night for Chizik of Shabbos, and kick off a campaign to the Mechazik Shabbos in the community, in the larger community. So we invited this Choshev Rav down, and he got up to speak. He was supposed to speak for about an hour. The first 20 to 25 minutes of his speech dealt with the following issue. It is a tremendous zilzul in Kavod Shabbos that he's noticed, that people unscrew many of the bulbs in their chandeliers before Shabbos, so they don't have the full light of the chandelier burning on Shabbos to save money. And that is a zilzul in Kavod Shabbos, because the more light in the house, the more Kavod Shabbos. Now, the Balabatim in my community, I don't think there was one who had a chandelier. I think there was some of them who didn't know what a chandelier was. I'll tell you 100% that was not the major issue of Shabbos in my community, that people unscrewed the light bulbs in their chandeliers. There was a few things, maybe not as important, but like carrying on Shabbos, borer on Shabbos, right, and a host of other things. Okay. Perhaps in the community where this Rav came from, those things were not a problem. So the biggest problem was Zilzul of Kavod Shabbos unscrewing the bulbs in the chandelier. If he had spoken in his community, perhaps that's what he should have spoken about for 25 minutes out of an hour. But he spoke in my community, and that was irrelevant completely. I learned from that if I'm ever asked to speak anywhere, that I first get in touch with the Rabbanim of the community and ask them what they think I should speak about, and what's important for that community, what's not important to me or my community, what's important to their community. I also ask them what I shouldn't speak about. Because if there's just been some kind of big machlokas there, and I'm going to open my mouth and speak about that, not knowing anything about it, I'm going to destroy that community, because I'm going to cause more turmoil. So, if you don't understand that you have to make what you say timely, fit the time, the place, the circumstances, then you're not going to carry with anybody. You're not going to speak their language. You're not going to speak to their issues. You're not going to speak from their perspective. And you're going to be like somebody who came from another planet, even though you're teaching them Torah. Because Torah never changes, and Torah has tremendous power. But everything has to be packaged. And the packaging, perhaps, is the main thing. That's the way it is in the Gashmiistic world. Because you can have the same old tithe, but if you put it in a new box and say, new improved, even though you didn't change anything, people will buy it. Because the packaging, that's what attracts people. So you need to know how to package the Torah properly. Okay, I have a few other points, but I need something to speak about next year. And I do not want to take away from Rabbi Lazarus' time. I know, but we're not going to run late, that we're going to eat late, that's for sure not. That's no shayla. To run for speakers to be late is one thing. To run late and eat late, that's impossible. So your time is going to be cut off, and I'm not going to be able to listen to anything. If you don't want to speak, that's, now do your chesed. But I have a feeling that you prepared something to say, and I don't have that much of a yetzer hara anymore to say everything I wrote down. I'll leave it for next year. I left this for this year. And therefore, I will be Mekayin to be Kodesh Mayetzer Hara by finishing now, and also having a chance to listen to somebody else. I get tired of listening to myself after a while. I know what I'm going to say. I don't know what you're going to say. So, I will gain, they will gain, and you will gain if we do this in a way that's yashrus, and I don't steal away from your time. So I am a big stickler on not only being frum, but trying to be a yosher also. So this is what yashrus is. In any case, I hope I give you something to think about. 2 points. One, listen to the people that you have to listen to, and neither connected me, the people who have to listen to you will listen to you. And secondly, know how to package the Torah properly, how to relate it to time, place, circumstance, and that way, in Yirtz Hashem, you'll be successful in being people who are makariv on the Torah, who are makariv as habrius l'Torah, which is the ultimate way of, as I heard Rabbi Orlowitz say, of bringing perfection and shalom to the world, right? Oev shalom, the rodev shalom, oev as habrius u'makariv l'Torah.